Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's go to CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. So I see that the SVB Bank has now been purchased. So we got through this unscathed?
Unscathed would not be correct, but we have gotten through this little piece of the puzzle. And First Citizens Bank, which is a bank out of North Carolina, this is a bank that had, as of the end of last year, $109 billion in assets. So it would be considered one of those mid-sized banks. When we say mid-sized banks, we're referring to banks that have deposits of between, say, $50 and $250 billion. So First Citizens was the 30th largest bank, and now all of a sudden, it's going to swallow up the $119 billion in deposits from Silicon Valley Bank. And so it's going to roughly double in size. And the bank is also going to assume $72 billion of Silicon Valley Bank's loans. That comes at a big discount. There's a whole bunch of money that's still going to be in receivership at Silicon Valley Bank. So the shareholders there are kind of waiting to see what fraction of a dollar they'll receive on their money. I'm guessing zero, but we'll see.
I've seen the stock market gyrate in the past week as they try to create confidence in the banking system. So does that end now? Is this a solid deal, or does this create another bank that's on the verge of that is teetering?
Well, I think that, you know, sort of if you look at sort of the short term news cycle, I think the news has been pretty good. And, you know, you say, OK, SVB has been purchased, Signature purchased, Credit Suisse absorbed. So now you're like, OK, that's good. What's next? Maybe we've got to keep an eye out. And we sure do of First Republic Bank, which is another problem. But I think the larger concern right this minute is not so much the whack-a-mole of the banks, but more of the stress that the banking sector problems put on the broader economy. And so when we look at that, we sort of have to listen to what the Fed said and what Fed officials are saying. And that is that, you know, when we look at the risk to the recession outlook, it's increased right now. It's increased because when there is banking uncertainty, what happens is a lot of institutions pull back on their lending. So if households and businesses are not being able to access money, they can't borrow, that means they can't spend. And as a result, that could slow down economic growth. That could certainly put a pressure on the labor market, and it could cause a recession. So just over the weekend yesterday, Neel Kashkari, who's a Fed official, went on Face the Nation and said, yep, the banking sector problems could actually cause a recession. So I think that's the larger issue now, is that we thought we were going to maybe skip, sort of narrowly escape a recession.
Yeah.
Now, maybe not so much.
So this is what the Fed was planning then. This is like throwing a meteor at the dinosaurs to see which species survive.
Well, I think that in a weird way, the banking crisis does take a little pressure off the Fed, because I think that it does do some of the work. I mean, it is true that Jerome Powell does not want to actually come out into a press conference and say, you know, it would be great, a pretty mild recession where we just kind of lost like a million jobs, not a lot, a million jobs. I hope it's not yours, whoever's watching this. And, you know, inflation calms down. He's not going to say that, but that is kind of what the Fed is hoping for.
Yeah, and I
know, and that's not to say that the Fed is going to get it right, because often when the Fed tries to engineer things, doesn't go exactly as planned. Let's look back at the record. They waited too long for the inflation fight to begin. Let's not go back to like the spring of 2021 when Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, said, there's inflation, hurry up, do something. And the Fed really did believe things were temporary or transitory. Okay, then the Fed waits. But while they're waiting, they're also buying bonds at the exact same time. They're actually pushing more money into the system. And so it is clear they waited too long and took too much action before they started fighting inflation. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, am I going to really trust these guys to very calmly press the brakes, tap, 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 avoid the recession and everything's fine. No, as it turns out, the tapping of the brakes really did feel like a slamming of the brakes. And some of these banks went right through the windshield because that rise in interest rates was so quick over the course of a year, 475 basis points, 4.75%, that there was a financial accident that was caused.
Okay, so what do ordinary squirrels like us do to protect our acorns in the meantime?
I'll tell you, the thing that you shouldn't do is stress out over things over which you have no control. So let's concentrate on where you do have control. The Fed is telling us a few things. Number one, we are going to keep interest rates higher for longer because inflation remains high. And number two, the banking sector issues are causing fears of a recession. So taking that together, here's what I read through. I say, wait, you know what I really need to do? I need to pay down any outstanding debt that is short term in nature, a credit card balance, an adjustable rate mortgage, a business loan that's tied to short term interest rates. I really need to get busy and try to pay that down as quickly as I can. And at the same time, I'd like to make sure that I have 6 to 12 months of living expenses in an FDIC or credit union insured bank that will allow me to kind of go through a recession and have the safety net that I need. Why is that safety net so important? Because if you don't have that safety net and you are one of the unlucky million or million and a half jobs that could be lost, then you're turning to other forms of either high interest credit or conversely, you're raiding your retirement account. So doing those two things, beefing up your emergency reserve fund, keeping it in an FDIC insured institution, and paying down short-term debt, those are the best things you can do right now.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And are there health tips that you thought were true, but which it turns out you can just ignore? Let's page the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. And the first health tip that was mentioned on this list, Dr. Cohen, is that you need 10,000 steps a day to boost your longevity. Apparently, that is not the case.
You know, Dave, it's true. Actually, a lot of things in medicine are just like numbers that are sort of grabbed out of the sky and applied. I could tell you many stories about this, but this is another one of those type of examples where, you know, somebody claimed that you needed 10,000 steps a day to actually boost your longevity. But once that number got selected, studies were done. And actually, really, the latest research shows that as few as 6,000 steps a day can do it. A study that was conducted last year showed that adults who were 60 years and older who did 6,000 and maybe 8,000 steps a day had a 50 to 60% lower chance of death. So it is not true that you need to do 10,000 steps a day to prolong your longevity.
Okay, here's the other one, that running will damage your knees. Therefore, don't run too much. What about that?
You know, actually, I've myself believed this for a long time. Back even when I was in college, you know, there were some studies that were being done. I majored in kinesiology at UCLA, so this was something that was of interest. And there was some suggestion that running not only could potentially damage your joints, but that if you ran in childhood, and I ran track in high school, and then in college, I, you know, continue to run, but not competitively, but that it could actually make you shorter because your growth plates would close up earlier.
What?
Due to the stress.
Really?
Yeah. And there were actually studies done to show that. But more recently, there's been some large studies that have actually shown that runners were actually half as likely to develop arthritis of their knee compared to non-runners. And runners tend to obviously have stronger muscles, especially their quadriceps, which actually help to protect the joints. So that is actually another that appears to be untrue.
Here's another one. You need to drink 8 glasses of water a day to maintain your health.
Right. So this is another example of, you know, picking a number out of the sky. And really, what they're saying is that you need to drink that much water to maintain adequate hydration. But if you drink too much water, then you're just going to be, you know, going to the restroom all the time. And if you drink too little water, you will gradually become dehydrated. And so the thing to really focus on is the, you know, color of your urine. Your urine should be, you know, light to medium yellow. That's the best indicator. And if it's dark, drink more water. And if it's really clear, well, you probably drank too much.
Okay, here's one. When you find you have back pain, you should immediately rest and not challenge your back.
So, you know, back pain oftentimes is because you have inadequate strength either in your abdomen, in your back, in your core muscles. So if you have back pain and you just like lay still and don't do anything, it may feel better, but actually you'll get more stiff. So you really should do a combination of acutely using ice and then later on using heat, do stretching exercises, and you should be mobile. Obviously you shouldn't do something to overly strain yourself initially, but just laying still and doing nothing isn't going to help. It'll actually make it worse.
And here's one that I hear a lot. What about the idea that you can lose weight and clear out toxins with a juice cleanse?
That's not true. And the thing is that you sort of have to think about what happens when you drink juice and what is juice. So juice is basically mostly water. There is some fiber as long as you haven't filtered it. There's a lot of vitamins and there's some acid typically. And so there's sugar. And so when you drink it, your body sort of processes all those components individually. The water gets processed by the kidneys. The vitamins get absorbed as vitamins otherwise would in our body. The fiber will go into our small intestines and be processed as fiber. And I guess the notion is most people don't really consume much fiber. And so if you drink a ton of juice, you're going to increase your fiber intake dramatically and that you may remove all these toxins from your body. But, you know, if you eat a normal, healthy diet with appropriate amounts of fruit, vegetables, grains, and other things that are high in fiber, then, you know, you're going to equivalently cleanse your body on a daily basis. You don't need to do it with a juice cleanse.
I figure the once every 10 years colonoscopy cleanse is quite enough.
That's plenty.
By the way, I'm told that as of this broadcast, we have been doing this segment for 6 years.
That's correct. We started in March of 2017. So
how many 10-minute consults have I had with you then over those years? It's like, what, 300?
Well, I mean, if you do the math, it's got to be in, you know, the ballpark of 300.
So I owe you like $3 million now, don't I?
Now you get free.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. There are two repeat offenders who are going to be out of circulation for a while. Time for this week's edition of Crime and Punishment. Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office joins us now. Bring us up today, Casey, on Dylan Jackman.
So he was somebody who you might have seen in a video that circulated pretty heavily on the internet last year, where he was at the North Seattle Lowe's and was walking out with a bunch of merchandise with a manager behind him saying, "Hey, don't do that." And this was somebody who was known by not only the staff at Lowe's, but also the Home Depot on Aurora, and was very frustrating for them because of the multiple repeat thefts. He was convicted on charges that we filed at the prosecutor's office on 2 counts of organized retail theft, 2 counts of burglary, and violation of an anti-harassment order. And what's unique about this case is the teamwork that went into it between the King County Prosecutor's Office and the Seattle City Attorney's Office. We were in contact about him really every week for months. His caseload was handled by the King County Prosecutor's High Priority Repeat Offender Unit, and he was also part of the high utilizer list at the City Attorney's Office.
And you had another repeat shoplifter sentenced as well, right?
So Dylan Jackman was one of them. And then there was also Levi Shirley, who was sentenced on Friday for burglary and organized retail theft. That involved the Old Navy downtown and the Target in the University District. What's unique are the two different approaches to the sentences that the courts handed down on Friday. So in Dylan Jackman's case, the longest possible sentence following the guidelines that are set by state lawmakers is 29 months. And so he's got about 10 months that he's already been in the King County Jail since we filed charges. And so with that and the earned release time that comes from the Department of Corrections, he'd likely be in jail until about January. And so the court ordered him on Friday to 29 months, which is the maximum that was available. And then in Levi Shirley's case, he had been in jail for roughly 2 months, and he was sentenced to a residential drug treatment program. The prosecutor's office asked for him to be there for 6 months, and then on top of that, have 2 years of supervised release with the Department of Corrections. So that way, if he doesn't follow the drug treatment order, then he's back in lockup. And if he violates his Department of Corrections supervision terms, then he's also back in front of the court.
And he's the guy who ripped off the target.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And then Dylan Jackman. So the trade-off there is he'll get 29 months total time. The difficulty is there isn't that Department of Corrections supervision available afterward. And also he acknowledged through his attorney that there was a substance use issue that was motivating these crimes. And so the drawback there is that he won't get treatment when he's in lockup for the next several months.
So the guy who got caught ripping off the Lowe's is not going to get drug treatment.
Right. That was something that the prosecutor's office, in coordination with the city attorney's office, had recommended. But understandably, the court said, you know, we don't want to take that approach because we're not sure that that will work. And also was mindful of the other people in the treatment program. Mm-hmm. So it will be interesting to see how these two people who are pretty similar in their crimes will play out. Ultimately, there's two different approaches. What we want, and I'm sure what the court wants too, is for the behavior to stop.
Right.
But there's also that concern too, and that's what we tried to address at the prosecutor's office, is if you don't address the root problem of what's motivating these crimes, we're likely to see them back on our desks again.
Okay, so the guy who ripped off the target is going to get the drug treatment because they think it'll work, but the guy who ripped off the Lowe's, the court decided that he couldn't be trusted to undergo the drug treatment.
Well, I'm not sure if it's that or that. The court noted that Dylan Jackman acted with some violence in some of these cases. But the hard part is these charge types under state law are not defined as violent crimes. And so what the court was mindful of in Dylan Jackman's case was the other people who were in that drug treatment.
So the guy who ripped off the Lowe's is going to be out, what, next January?
Roughly,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, but without any drug treatment. So
right.
So what happens then?
Then he's back out. And
yeah.
And hopefully things change. But either way, the prosecutor's office and the city attorney's office will stay mindful of people exactly like this.
And even though these are considered nonviolent crimes, they don't feel that way to the victims who were there when these guys came in. You talked with Nicole Lawson, the prosecutor who was in charge of these cases.
Yeah. And she is responsible for organized retail theft cases, or most of them. And that number last year has double compared to the year before. Here's what she had to say about handling these cases.
I think often people get the idea that Lowe's or Home Depot are just these big box stores and they're nameless and faceless. And that's not true, because those stores are made up of individuals who care deeply about the business, the place that they work. And it can be pretty demoralizing for them when they see these repeated thefts and feel like they can't do anything to stop it. I also tell all the retailers at every meeting that I have, my metaphorical door is always open. They are always welcome to call me.
Okay. Now, another case that came into the office is one involving a caretaker who is taking care of an elderly person and then decided there was a little additional money to be made here. Bellevue Police have been working on this for years. Tell us about this one.
We really appreciate the work of Bellevue Police here. They worked on this for years, and Detective Andy Norton is especially appreciated, because this case involves the financial exploitation of an elderly woman who was dependent on her caregiver. And that caregiver is accused of taking control of this woman's assets and then spending her money. Here's a clip from Senior Deputy Prosecutor Paige Ulrey, who's handling this case.
I think the two things about this case that are so common are that the victim had dementia and that the victim was socially isolated.
And so the big question is, if you're listening to this and you know somebody who might be in a situation like this, what what should you do?
If you know somebody who you are concerned about, an older adult who you're worried about, the thing to do is not to wait and not to just hope for the best, but to call someone. You can call the police and ask them to conduct a welfare check. You can call Adult Protective Services and ask them to look into the situation. Or you can check on the elder yourself. But what we need to be doing is reaching out to older adults who are, like the victim in this case, isolated and therefore very vulnerable.
So if you do suspect that a neighbor or somebody else you're acquainted with is actually being exploited by a caregiver or someone else, who do you call?
Adult Protective Services or report it to police. The key is to act on it right away, to not wait and say, well, maybe this won't happen or maybe I'm overthinking it or maybe somebody else will take care of it. Sooner is better.
Casey McNerthy from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Thank you, Casey.
Thanks, Dave.
Capital gains and the level of pain. This morning's commentary, sponsored by WaFed Bank. It turns out the state Supreme Court had no problem deciding that taxing capital gains is not an income tax. So now we have to decide how worried we should be. Speaking only for myself, looking at the numbers, my first reaction was, wouldn't it be nice to actually be in a position to have to pay this tax? Because it would mean I was in a position to cash in more than $250,000 in capital gains, which I'm not. But suppose I invented the ultimate chatbot. Chat Dave Ross, capable of generating realistic spoken commentaries, and the value of my Chat Dave Ross stock jumps by $20 million, and suddenly I feel the need to cash that in on the $20 million yacht of my dreams, the Lady Michelle.
Luxury motor yacht Lady Michelle is a very popular and well-performing 55-meter superyacht. A highlight below deck is the split-level owner suite, which is situated on the main deck and features separate his and hers bathrooms,
yes,
its own panoramic observation lounge to enjoy views, and a private study.
Wow.
There's a gym, a salon for guests to gather, and a dedicated dining space for meals inside.
Yes. Unfortunately, under the Washington capital gains tax, once I pay 7% on my gains over $250,000, I only have $18,600,000 left. Now I have to go for the discount yachts.
Here is a list of private yachts available for under $20 million.
It's humiliating. I'd have to settle for the Majesty 100.
The yacht's unreserved magnificence can be seen throughout her generous 100-foot or 32-meter length.
Talk about lipstick on a pig. Now instead of 180 feet, I have to shoehorn my guests into 100 feet? However, I don't want to go too far in making light of this because according to our tax whisperer, Ken Williams, he knows of a few wealthy clients who might just say, enough of this, I'm out.
It's a factor that people look at. Now there's less of an incentive to stay in Washington because it's no longer the tax haven for large portfolios that create a lot of capital gains.
So the governor, now that he has his wish, needs to make this state the best incubator in the world for startups. For most entrepreneurs, like it or not, money is a major motivation. I don't want to see a flotilla of Washington entrepreneurs sailing for Florida.
Time for your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Robert W. Baird. Thanks to a good Samaritan, a dog and its owner have been reunited after 7 years and thousands of miles apart. Jennifer tells NBC affiliate WYFF-TV she found the dog roaming the streets on a rainy night in Greenville, South Carolina.
I saw him limping down the middle of the road in the dark, in the rain.
The dog was in rough shape.
My first thought was, I need to take him to the emergency vet and I need to get him checked for a microchip.
And that instinct paid off because the microchip provided two names, one for the dog, Nugget, and one for the owner, Jesse Springer, who just so happens to live 2,000 miles away in New Mexico.
Can you hear Mom?
Nugget!
There they are being reunited. Jesse says Nugget ran away 7 years ago.
When Jen texted me, like, I was like, wait, what? Like, I mean, this dog never left my side, so I thought he had, like, walked off to die because he was already old.
Jesse says for years she tried to find Nugget, but thanks to a complete stranger from Carolina Loving Hound Rescue.
We have reunited animals that have been gone for a week or a month, but typically within a 100-mile radius, but nothing like this.
They were flown in from New Mexico to Greenville, South Carolina to be reunited.
Feather shoes.
They put me on a flight immediately and here I am. Like, it's insane.
It was an emotional reunion, 7 years in the making. Unclear how Nugget got from one side of the country to the other and what happened on that excellent adventure. Instead of running from home this time, Nugget will be able to go back home to find his true owner.
Nugget must have seen that Disney movie and gotten a few tips on how to do this.
Y'all never forget where your bread's buttered. Don't right. you run it. My cat always, before he passed, of course, but he always would like try to get outside. It would take like 10 steps and then he'd be like, eh, it's
yeah.
too cold.
Yeah,
right? right?
.748 Seattle's Morning News, and now from the Gene Ursula Show, which starts at 9, here he is, G. Scott. Bobby Wagner's coming back.
Man.
Wish granted.
Man, man, man. So, this reminds me of, like, everything was happening in the courts, the divorce proceedings and the custody battle. You feel me? Like, all of the custody was going on. And when I say the custody battle, who's the kids? Us, the yeah. fans. We are the kids. And we're sitting back and we're going back and forth and seeing it happen. And then what happened was, is the Seahawks and Bobby sat in a room together for the first time with no lawyers, right? No judge, no nobody. And they said, hey, look, things didn't go right. I'll admit my side, you admit your side. You know, that's this. You know, we used to have good times together. You know what I mean? We spent a lot of time. We had some magical years. Remember that one year? We had a real good year, 2013. Life was good.
Yeah.
And so you got to talking about that good time. And so the Seahawks said, well, I'll tell you what. You come live back in the house, okay, for 1 year.
We'll try it out. Yeah.
Oh, so this could go longer?
I mean, let's not do that.
Yeah.
Let's just do a 1 year deal. When we leave out of this room, we're going to tell the kids, the fans, that we're getting back together.
Uh-huh.
4 year to do what's best for the house. There's a lot of bills that need to be paid. There's a lot of repair that needs to be done. Things are good at the house. The bills was getting paid while Bobby was gone.
Now, why do we need Bobby for a year? Why do we need him?
Because you got to clean some stuff up around there, right?
Gotta like fix some leaks in the roof.
Like the Seahawks built the patio. But they didn't stain the deck yet.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
The stain on the deck. He's going to put the finishing touch on.
There's new cabinets, but there's no handles. Uh-huh. All right, let me just get back to being serious. Bobby Wagner's back. Looks like it's going to be a one-year, $7 million deal. I think this is amazing. This field's a need that they need at the linebacker position right there. Jordan Brooks is going to be coming back, an opportunity to play alongside him and also teach him a little bit more of the ropes. This brings in another leader into that locker room. And let's just be real. This is a good thing for all. Bobby Wagner is back where he needs to be.
Remind me why he left again?
Because they didn't want to pay him that $20
million. I see. Okay.
You know what I mean?
All right. But now they're paying him $7 million for 1 year.
Business.
Yeah. So, sometimes you have to leave to find out how much you're worth.
Right? And that's another thing, right? I have been telling you guys, and I want to put this chance to remind you, the Seahawks culture and what they have built over there is so great that even when players leave,
they want to come back.
You know what I mean? They go and they call around 2 a.m. and say,
you up?
Colleen, you know the drill.
Yeah.
You up?
And Pete Carroll said,
Yep. I'm up. And then Bobby's like, I miss you. You know what I mean? Like, everybody out here is just not like you.
What was he making at the other place?
He made 10. He was making 10 a year. He had a 3-year deal, but it was like, you know, up front, basically. So he made 10 with them. So he left here. He was going to make, let me be exact, he was going to make $18 million here. Mm-hmm. He left to the Rams, made 10. So you subtract that, he lost 8, feel me? But he comes back here, right? Mm-hmm. And you can essentially say that, let's just say he's coming here to make that 7. Now, he could have gone somewhere else and probably made 10, but 10 on the East Coast is not better than 7 here at home where his home is. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, like, yeah,
some things money can't buy.
Yeah, some exactly. things money can't yeah. buy. Sometimes, you know what I'm saying? You know. Mm-hmm. But again, so he goes out. He could have lived with the rich lady. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He could have lived with her and made more money. Yeah. But he wanted to come back home to mama.
And we are so happy.
Was, you know, it is way too early for your listeners to be hearing me go this wild right now. But I just, this is how I look at football and life.
It's
I apologize.
No, it really is. Yeah. Work. Yeah, absolutely.
Dave, so, I mean, it's Dave, all about dating. I know.
Dave, can you don't have any experience of when you just left and been gone. And no. Mama, you up? And none of that?
He's been here 45 years.
I got to tell you, Dave, you don't want to. It's not fun.
It's,
no.
Have.
It's, Colleen, it's not fun.
No. I've always been loyal. So.
Wait. That's not mean you're not loyal. Well, I guess I wouldn't.
Okay.
All right, let me get out of here now. Sorry, if I know this is a family show.
Yeah.
See you guys.
Well, it used to be, but
it's G. Scott it up.
At starting at 9 o'clock on Cairo News Radio. Thank you, G. Off you go. Could there be a United States Supreme Court challenge to Washington's capital gains tax now that the state Supreme Court has given it the thumbs up? Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Matt Markovich, who joins us live. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Dave. Dave's day 78 of the 105-day session. If you want to look at the other way, 27 days left unless the governor calls for a special session, which he could if he doesn't get his $4 billion housing plan passed. He was asked about that last week if he would call that. He says it's basically too soon to say that. Wednesday's a big day because they're going to cut off all the policy bills that have to pass out of their chambers that don't have a budget connection. And so I thought we'd talk about capital gains. Yes, Dave, I'm sorry to hear that you have to downgrade your yacht now because your capital gains, you're going to be hit with that tax there. But anyway, like you said, the state Supreme Court on Friday ruled 7-2, overturning a March 22 decision by a Douglas County Superior Court judge that concluded that the tax was unconstitutional because it was a tax on income. Now, that measure took effect last year, and the first payments are due before April 18th, next month. Tax imposes 7% tax on the gains made from sale of stocks and bonds and other high-end assets in excess of $250,000 for both individuals and couples. And it's expected to raise roughly $500 million a year from 7,000 taxpayers. Now, in her opinion for the majority, Justice Devereaux Stevens wrote that the capital gains tax is appropriately characterized as an excise tax because it's levied on the sale or exchange of capital assets, not the capital gains or the gains themselves. It's like a one-time transactional thing. Now, Governor Jay Inslee says it's been a long time wait for a tax like this.
Washington State has been waiting for 134 years for a fair tax system, and today that has arrived.
Now, the governor says this provides equity, which the rich will now pay more of their fair share.
This is increasing the fairness and the equity in our state, and it therefore is a fantastic achievement.
Now, the governor was asked directly, will this lead to an income tax that people believe may happen, which is constitutionally prohibited in the state of Washington?
No, that's pretty simple. One word answer. The Republicans just delight in this boogeyman and they think it can get them elected and hasn't worked for 20 years. And I don't think it's going to work.
Now, State Representative April Berg, a Democrat, shared what many of the Democratic majority are feeling.
I am over the moon with today's ruling. Today's decision not only confirms the state's position that the capital gains tax is an excise tax, but it also provides the much needed clarity for us to move forward with significant reform to our tax structure.
So I reached out to former Washington Court Supreme Court Justice and former State Senator Phil Talmadge, and he get his take on it. I had a long conversation. This is about a 30-second soundbite, but I think it's interesting to hear about the history and what the court did by bypassing history about this tax.
Historically, the Supreme Court of Washington in the 1930s concluded that income was property. It wasn't something that was subject to an excise tax because the legislature in the Great Depression came up with a great idea of saying, well, income is something that we can attach an excise tax to. And they tried to do that. They treated income as something on which they imposed an excise tax. And the Supreme Court back then said, nope, you can't do that because income is property. It's not a transactional kind of thing. This this opinion basically sidesteps it.
So what he's basically saying is the same arguments that were used, maybe argued better this time at the state Supreme Court, that were used back in the 30s, passed this time because the court makeup is different. The court back in the 30s was different from the court today, and that's why we have this ruling by the state Supreme Court that it's okay. But there's a portion, he says, of the ruling that involves federal law.
There's a piece of the case that involves the dormant commerce clause, federal commerce clause.
So with that in mind, I asked him if there's a chance there could be an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
The U.S. Supreme Court cannot override our state Supreme Court on its interpretation of the Washington Constitution. But of course, the U.S. Supreme Court can pronounce on federal constitutional issues, and that may be where these people go next.
So, I don't get it. So what does the Commerce Clause have to do with this?
Well, it's part of for me, I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to argue what the Commerce Clause does, but it's an element of the ruling.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to hang your hat on an appeal, which many people do, you can appeal just a portion of the ruling. Therefore, if it's based on this Commerce Clause, which in the court did talk about that, you can go to the U.S. Supreme Court or go the U.S. appellate route to appeal this. Now, is that going to happen? We don't know. Your buddy Rob McKenna, who argued on behalf of the taxpayers who are against this tax, he may have a better answer when he talks to his clients about this. So whether they're going to do that. So it's still, they're going to start collecting this. They're collecting this tax. They're already starting to spend it across the street, the Democratic majority. But there is this little federal law there that could make it a little tougher for the state to really make to say this is a home run.
And there was also a discussion of death with dignity. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting, Dave, because, you know, I've been trying to pick bills that have some controversy. Most of the bills that are passing that we don't talk about are 94-0 or, you know, it's a unanimous thing. But this death with dignity was not unanimous. It passed, I'll explain what it is, but just to set it up, it passed the Senate 28-20, and it just passed the House 53-43. So there's some divisiveness. And basically what it does, it allows the more people to perform the activity of a death with dignity, including registered nurses, physician's assistants, and it requires that 15-day waiting period between the first and second oral request for medications to 7 days and eliminates a 48-hour waiting period for a written request. It basically speeds things up. Mm-hmm. And those lethal medications can be delivered in the mail to the person. Now, supporters like Democratic Representative Strom Peterson spoke about how important it was for him and his family to present, to be there when his mom decided to end her life.
And it was an incredible honor for me and my siblings to be able to help guide her into the next realm.
Now, opponents like Republican Representative Cindy Jacobson argue that speeding up the process may affect people who are not in the right frame of mind to make a life-ending decision.
I worry if there could be some coercion of our old ones, that they might just think that the world's better off without them.
So finally, the Senate added a little amendment, which a lot of people used to justify death with dignity. Was that it was called intractable suffering, and they removed that definition. But they also they made it harder to get a prescription before the 7 day waiting period. So that was a trade off. But you know, it was a very controversial bill. But now it's passed both houses, and that's up to the governor. It's one of the, it's now on his desk to sign.
So it's passed. Yeah.
Yeah, it's passed both the House and Senate. But again, this is one of those more controversial bills, and there have been a few of them this session. This is one of them.
Matt Markovich from the legislature. Matt, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. I think it's fair to say we're all still in shock at the ruling of the state Supreme Court saying that the capital gains tax is constitutional. I didn't expect that. I'm pretty sure the attorneys who are arguing in favor of classifying it as an income tax didn't expect that. So let's go to our tax whisperer, Ken Williams of CLA. Were you expecting it?
Well, when we went into the Supreme Court hearing, we really thought that it was unlikely. But as we listened to the arguments, you'll remember at the time, I thought, well, it could go either way. And lo and behold, the 7 of the 9 justices decided it was constitutional, and now the tax exists.
Well, I mean, as a longtime student of IRS rules, does it make sense to you?
Well, logic and the tax code seldom align. And frankly, if you take the average layperson's look at this and say, gee, it looks like an income tax, it talks like an income tax, it acts like an income tax, it's an income tax, but the state made a successful argument that it's not really an income tax, it's an excise tax. And so by weaving through those definitions and provisions, they were able to successfully argue before the Supreme Court that even though it's based on an income tax item from your income tax return, it's still a tax on a transaction. And so it's not considered an income tax.
So this will end up being then a 7% tax on capital gains that are realized. In other words, you sell the stock, you take the money in any calendar year, correct?
That's right. 7% of net capital gains that exceed $250,000 per person or couple.
Now, you work with rich people all the time, figuring out their taxes, trying to legally minimize how much they have to pay. What do you think the reaction to this will be? Are there ways to evade this?
Well, there are ways to plan around it. And realistically, for most taxpayers in Washington, this tax will not apply. Most of the run-of-the-mill Washingtonian, if they have that kind of a gain, it's usually from the sale of their home or another piece of real estate. And real estate is specifically excluded from the tax, as well as certain other types of transactions. It really is targeted towards gains from portfolio investment stocks.
Right. And we should make that
so
clear.
Forth.
A lot of people have huge capital gains on their homes, and that is not taxed by this.
That's correct. And there are some other exclusions, sale of a closely held family business. But for the person who has large portfolio gains, this hits them directly.
Could a person legally incorporate themselves, let's say, in Idaho and not have to pay this tax?
Yeah, good question. So the tax is based on the domicile of the taxpayer. So a person who is domiciled in Washington is going to be subject to the tax on any capital gains that they have that aren't specifically excluded. And then those who are not Washington residents are also taxed on any gains that occur within Washington, regardless of their state of residency.
Okay, so give me some examples of other things besides stocks that are subject to this tax then.
For example, if you are an owner in a business and that business is sold and has a large gain on the sale of that business, that's going to be subject to the tax.
Now, how does the state go about enforcing this?
That's one of the real problems with this. So Washington State requires that you file a copy of your federal income tax return to the Washington State excise tax return. And that's the starting point for determining what tax you owe. Then you have to go through and substantiate any adjustments. But it's interesting that they start with your federal income tax return to determine the tax that is not an income tax.
But they are relying on people to self-report, is what you're telling me.
Yeah. And what the reporting mechanism for finding those who don't report? Well, I don't know.
Ken Williams, our tax whisperer from CLA. Ken, thanks very much.
Thank you, Dave.